to call to order the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. We have a crowded schedule today, but I think we're going to get through everything in a productive, efficient way. I'm going to start off with a public hearing on Senate Bill 275. Administrator Donovan, if you could give us a brief summary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 275 requires that a student receive training in cardiopulmonary resuscitation and in the use of automated external defibrillators in order to receive a high school diploma in the state of Oregon. Thank you.
All right, so we have some people signed up. I'm not sure how you want to do this. Stephanie Tamasweet from the Heart Association, if you want to bring up everybody or...
Just in order?
Okay. Why don't you start, and then we'll go with Dr. Joaquin Sigueroa, then Jim Joyce is on deck, and Sandy and Raul Meekums in the dugout.
Thank you very much, Chair Haas and members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Tamasweet, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the American Heart Association and the American Stroke Association in Oregon. Thank you very much for your time today. I'm going to keep my comments very brief because I know you want to hear from the other folks with us. I also submitted written testimony for the record for the committee. I did want to just mention a few things. First of all, I have a stack that I will just show you of cards signed by people from all across the state. These are postcards and letters signed from individuals all across the state asking that we train every high school student in CPR before they graduate from high school. These have come from all different areas across the state. Some CPR instructors have collected them and volunteers. They've done a phenomenal job. So we're here today to talk about a bill that would train every high school student in CPR. It's very simple. We do have an amendment that I want to call your attention to that would provide schools with some flexibility and how they would accomplish this. And I submitted, like I said, some written testimony about that. But very simply, what we're asking is not certifying students in CPR, but rather the training of the skills that are critical for saving a life later on. The skills that students learn while in high school, they take with them for a lifetime. And if we trained every high school student before they graduated, we would be turning out 45,000 lifesavers every year onto the streets in Oregon, which we think is pretty incredible. We can learn the skills in less time than it takes to watch a TV sitcom, and it can easily be incorporated into a PE or health class, which all students are required to take already in order to graduate from high school in Oregon. So we're strongly supportive of CPR and training of all people, as many as we can reach, and we urge your support of Senate Bill 275, which would do that. And thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Joaquin Sigueroa, and I'm a practicing cardiologist and clinical chief of the Knight Cardiovascular Institute at OHSU. Today, I'm here representing the American Heart Association and our community, where I currently serve as a board president for the Oregon and Southwest Washington chapter. We have all heard that heart disease is the number one killer of Oregonians, and in fact, Americans. And almost all of us have been personally impacted by heart disease, either because we ourselves struggle with it, or it has touched the lives of a family member or a friend. Every 25 seconds, somebody has a heart attack. Every 39 seconds, somebody dies of a heart attack. By the time we're done presenting here this afternoon, 15 people in America will have died of a heart attack. Most people, almost 90%, who experience a cardiac arrest at home work in a public location, and die because they don't receive immediate CPR from someone on the scene. In fact, only about 25 to 30% of the population knows CPR, and sometimes even individuals who are knowledgeable are not in a situation where they actually apply their skills. Given right away, however, CPR can double or even triple a person's chance of survival. These statistics are even more significant in areas geographically where there is a high percentage of minorities, where even fewer people are trained in CPR, and as a consequence, fewer people survive. What is sudden cardiac arrest? Sudden cardiac arrest is not the same as what we think of as a heart attack. It occurs when the electrical impulses in the heart become rapid and chaotic, and are unable, therefore, to result in coordinated beating of the heart muscle, and therefore there's an inadequate amount of blood flow going to the body. A heart attack occurs when the blood supply to part of the muscle is blocked, and it, in fact, is also a common cause of cardiac arrest. Risk factors for sudden cardiac arrest include a personal history of heart disease, a family history of coronary artery disease, heart rhythm disorders, heart failure, substance abuse, smoking, high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, and other factors such as a thickened heart muscle, a common cause of sudden death in children who are school age. But importantly, sudden cardiac arrest can happen to anybody at any time. Many victims appear healthy without known heart disease or other risk factors, and in fact, this accounts for approximately two-thirds of those individuals. In America, nearly 360,000 people have a sudden cardiac arrest every year, and only 10% survive, most commonly because they do not receive timely CPR. We know that bystander CPR saves lives. If no CPR is provided or no defibrillation occurs within 3 to 5 minutes of a collapse, the chance of survival immediately drops. CPR is a life-saving solution and doubles or triples survival rates. New American Heart Association guidelines recommend hands-only CPR for youth and adults who suffer from out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. It is easier to teach, it is easier to learn, and in fact, easier to perform. In fact, hands-only CPR can be taught in just 30 minutes, less time than a high school class period, and less time than watching a typical TV sitcom. In the last 2 weeks, I've had two patients, each with disparate outcomes. The first, a 43-year-old individual this past Monday who experienced out-of-hospital cardiac arrest due to a heart attack, but had bystander-initiated CPR and survived without any neurologic damage. Another, a 67-year-old gentleman who had out-of-hospital arrest at home, whose spouse did not know CPR, in which it took 7 minutes for a first responder to begin, and that individual, although they survived, had brain death and therefore did not have a meaningful recovery. All Americans should be trained in how to save the life of a loved one or stranger. Schools are, in fact, an excellent place to start because they are the gateway to an entire generation which will be able to respond when they witness somebody in the community or home experiencing sudden cardiac death. Teaching students CPR develops real-world skills and responsibility. The lessons they learn, they will take with their lifetime and share with others. Please support Senate Bill 275, which will ensure that all Oregon high school students learn CPR before graduating from high school. Doing so will add 45,000 trained lifesavers to our community each year. Thank you so much for your time, and I'm happy to respond to any questions which you might have.
Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate that. Questions for either one of these two? Doctor, do you advocate teaching CPR along with learning how to deal with an AED? Is that how it goes now? Or?
Yes, both are critical. So the first establishes circulation again, which protects the important organs, and importantly, improves the chances that when the AED is applied that you can restore a synchronized heart rhythm and save that individual's life. So both are critical.
It's interesting because AEDs themselves, it doesn't take any real training to operate them, but most people don't even know that, and so the training is to tell them that you don't need to know anything, but sometimes you see those things with red lights, they look a little bit intimidating on the wall.
So you're right, educating folks about that and understanding that the machine will talk you through and it will make the decisions is an important part of making it accessible, even if present.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm going to go down the list. Tim Joyce? I'm sorry, Jim Joyce.
Chairman Haas, members of the committee, my name is Jim Joyce. I am a Major League Baseball umpire, and I am here in support of Senate Bill 275, CPR in schools. I just so happen to be one of those bystander hands-only CPR givers in a situation in Phoenix, Arizona in August of last year where one of the food workers had sudden cardiac arrest and was literally down on the floor and literally passed in front of me. And after doing some vitals and checking her vitals, knowing she was not breathing and she had no heartbeat, I immediately started hands-on only CPR. And within 3 to 4 minutes, the paramedics got there and they rendered the AED and had to shock her 6 times by the time they got her to the hospital. But today she is a survivor and she's a very good friend of mine. And I would really support this bill because like these kids that are going to be talking here a minute from Valley Catholic, you have 45,000 possible first responders. And I think that is a huge number. And like the doctor said, if we just get over that hump about jumping in and doing hands-only CPR, I think we'll be very, very beneficial. But to teach it in schools, I think, is absolutely imperative. I learned it when I was in school 100 years ago. And I still remembered it and also kept up with it. And I think it's the intrigue of the CPR part of it. The mouth-to-mouth part is gone now. It's the hands-only CPR. And so I think it's very, very important that when kids get out of, from eighth grade into high school, even recertified after when they graduate, I think is extremely important. You gain a lot of first responders. If you have any questions, I'll take questions on the CPR first and baseball second.
Well, the lady in your example is blessed to have you standing by. And I don't mean to make light of that, but it sounds like you called her out, but thanks to your action, she was safe.
Oh. Nope. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Not bad.
Not bad. Not bad. Not bad at all.
Senator Beyer? Don't want to? Okay. Well, thank you for your testimony and for your effort down there.
Thank you very much. I appreciate letting me speak in front of you today. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You bet, Jim. Okay, Sandy and Raul Meekums.
Chairman Haas, committee members, my name is Raul Meekums. I'm here to, of course, speak in behalf of Senate Bill 275. This is my wife. You can tell your name.
Sandra Sharp Meekums.
I experienced sudden cardiac arrest at our home on August 12th. We live in Tualatin. It was on a Sunday morning, and my wife and I were up early. She was going to have a bridal shower for one of her employees, a friend. And it was just one of those days what we normally do. And I left the room where we were in to go to the master bathroom from what I know nothing. Let me put it this way. Everything I know, I've been told. I don't remember the day before. I don't remember the day of. I don't know the two following days. My wife heard a thunk. We had a new cat in the house. She thought it was a cat playing. She looked down. Both cats were staring at her. She goes, not cats. And then she knew where I went. She, on her way, she had the wherewithal to grab a phone. She saw I was passed out, flat on the floor, blood from my mouth, foaming at the mouth, and she called 911. She had training within CPR at high school. She's younger than I am, so mine's even further back. And the 911 operator walked her through hands-only CPR. She performed CPR on me for 5.5 minutes prior to the Tualatin Police Department arriving. Every car the Tualatin Police Department has an AED in it. Then the Tualatin Valley Fire came, ambulance came, and they continued on. I had several other cardiac arrest events that day. The last one was, I think, six, eight hours later, and they performed CPR hands only on me for 44 minutes at the hospital. By all accounts, everybody thought I'd be pretty much brain dead, and I'd never be able to do anything ever again. But due to the fact of my wife's immediate attention to me with the hands-on-only CPR, I survived. The impact this can possibly have, in my opinion, is teaching students in high school the ability to do this is, I look at it, it's so multifaceted in the community. They can observe these items in the community and address it in their own home where most cardiac arrests occur, and also at school, because we always hear of these incidents several times a year where students are having a cardiac arrest and collapsing either in the sports field or on a court or even just in school. The more people we can arm with the ability to address this situation is absolutely the best, and you cannot put a price tag on anybody's life. And I feel very, very fortunate for my wife, for all the first responders, and those that have been properly trained to take care of individuals such as myself.
Yes, Chair Hash and members of the committee, I am here to support the Bill 275 as well. If you would have told me a year ago that I would be performing hands-on only CPR, I would have thought you were crazy. I would have had a flash like, oh, I haven't had any practice since high school. And I think it's very important that we teach the younger generation that it is something that is not intimidating, and it does save lives, and it does prevent brain damage if you respond immediately. Putting this in schools and education curriculum, they can help educate their parents, their grandparents, and it can become a topic of conversation at the dinner table. So I am very lucky that I had a 911 operator that was able to walk me through it, and we were able to start CPR probably within 30 seconds of the incident. He had a total of, he was declared deceased for 62 plus minutes, so it was a series of events that day, and they all refer back to it was the immediate response that kept him alive, but also kept his quality of life. So I thank you for listening to us, and I hope you will really consider making this mandatory in schools. And any questions, I would be happy to answer.
Thank you for that story. Any questions? Well, Mr. Meekums, when we say we're glad to have you here today, I mean we're glad to have you here today. So.
And I'm very glad to be here to listen to you and to share it with you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, didn't you and I do something about AEDs a few sessions ago? I believe we did. Yeah.
We're getting there. Mark Stevens and Josh Moore.
Good afternoon, Chairman Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Stevens. I'm the division chief for EMS for Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue. I've been a paramedic for over 30 years and have watched CPR come a long way. We never used to see survivors like you just saw. And I just did a survivor gathering last Friday of somebody who had hands-only CPR and the AED that we had placed. And he's alive and well, and was cracking jokes with us last Friday, which just never happened before. I've turned in written testimony from Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and as president of the EMS section of the Oregon Fire Chiefs, we also support Senate Bill 275. Hands-only CPR is easy. It's extremely easy and has proven effective in scientific research, and we see survivors now more than we ever have before. The past fears, like mouth-to-mouth breathing, those kind of things that kept people from beginning CPR are in the past. You can't make a dead person worse. I mean, just put your hands in the middle of the chest, press hard and fast, about 100 beats a minute to the tune staying alive. All somebody has to do is call 911 and start. This can be learned easily in high school. We do urge that as if this passes and goes to high school or before graduation, that it be made as simple as possible as the procedure actually is, so that there's no barriers to CPR being performed or taught in the schools. Your local fire departments and EMS stand ready across the state to assist the schools as needed. Without CPR, as paramedics, we see that the other side, what happens, and where people are brain dead or we can't bring them back. There's another song with 100 beats a minute called Another One Bites the Dust, and we don't like that one at all. And we want to keep them staying alive. So to read from the last paragraph of one of our testimonies from the EMS section, it says, during the half hour of a committee hearing, approximately 65 to 72 people suffer an out-of-hospital cardiac arrest in this country. With such a simple solution to something so important at hand, we should all move with haste to support Senate Bill 275. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Chairman Haas, committee members, my name is Joshua Moore. I'm a paramedic firefighter with Eugene Fire. And about a year ago, I created a program to increase rates of survival from cardiac arrest. And what I did is I looked at the best places in the country that have the best chances of survival. So it's 50% in the best places in the country of surviving VFib arrest. The worst is 0%. And really, it's all about strengthening that link, every link in the chain of survival. So the first link in that chain of survival is to get the public to recognize cardiac arrest and start chest compressions. So that's really the first part of my program is we started an awareness campaign where we taught people what does cardiac arrest look like, and then we acquired CPR Anytime kits from the American Heart Association, and we offer public training to the public. Anybody can request CPR training, and we go into every seventh grade classroom and teach all the seventh graders locally. So each superintendent of all our school districts in Eugene and Springfield support this. We've taught 1,000 seventh graders so far and 3,000 community members. It's important to note that this compression CPR training can be done in 10 minutes. There's a video that you'll see in the kit here, and if you just want to learn compression CPR, it's only 10 minutes of your time. And identifying cardiac arrest is much simpler than it used to be. It's just two things you look for. Are they responding, and are they breathing normally? If those answers are no, you start chest compressions, because we know with the DART study out of Seattle, you can't hurt somebody with chest compressions. You're only gonna help. And it takes a minute of 100 compressions or more to get blood into the brain. So all those models of mouth-to-mouth that we've taught since 1966, none of those models, no matter whether it was 5-to-1 compression to ventilation or 30-to-2 or 15-to-1, none of those numbers changed the rate of survival. When compression CPR came out in the communities that it's tried, it triples the rate of survival. So I really strongly support Senate Bill 275. Teach our kids how to recognize cardiac arrest. They are not too young. They're eager to show that they have value to the community. And another reason I feel so strongly about it is 2 years ago, my wife's best friend, Ray, my wife's best friend's dad, Ray, died in cardiac arrest. And they were at the YMCA doing a workout. Ray was a friend of mine. He was 49 years old. He took no medication. He had no prior cardiac history. During the YMCA workout, he said, I think I got the flu, and he went and sat out in the truck. When they walked out to the truck, Ray's family tells me that he had his eyes open and he was gasping for breath. He was in cardiac arrest, but they failed to recognize those two simple signs. He wasn't responsive and he wasn't breathing normally. If they would have pulled Ray out of the truck and started chest compressions and defibrillated, he'd still be alive today. And Ashley Garza wants me to tell everybody, learn compression CPR. It's easy to learn the signs, and I think it's time that we teach our kids. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, Senator Cruz.
Is Seattle still the best place?
Well, Seattle's one of among the top. You know, Tucson, Arizona, Kansas City, Missouri, Seattle, Washington, Rochester, New York, they all have 50% survival.
Yeah, last time I checked, I mean, they were right at the top.
So. They've averaged 50% for a couple of years, but they've been 46 to 50 for a decade.
Facing
them. Yes, we are. Catching up.
Which is comfort to me. My daughter lives there. So.
Yep.
Questions? Thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you.
Amanda Nguyen.
No, okay, I'll sit up then. Okay.
Start off with your name. And.
Okay, so my name is Amanda Nguyen, and I'm an eighth grader at Valley Catholic. Learning CPR has been really easy. Our teacher has been able to fit it in about two class periods because he went a little bit more in depth. The first class, he taught us how to do hands-only CPR, and the second one, he taught us all how to use an AED. So it's pretty simple. It's like two simple steps. You learn look, listen, and feel for breathing, and then you do chest compressions until EMS arrives. He told us that most of people don't want to do this because they're scared or they think someone else will jump in and do it. And if everyone just waits to do it, no one ends up doing it, and then people start dying. So we were trained, and over the Thanksgiving break, he told us it's our job as eighth graders. It's part of our class to go out and teach at least five people hands-only CPR. And so our class so far has taught 1,049 people hands-only CPR within our class. And last Saturday, we had our speech tournament. So during the tiebreaker round, since whoever was not in it would wait in the gym, and our class taught people their hands-only CPR, we were able to teach about 227 people. And on Sunday, there was a lady who we taught. She was at a restaurant, and someone at the table next to her had a cardiac arrest, and so she was able to save their life, knowing the knowledge that we taught to her at the speech tournament. So it was really fun. Okay.
That's terrific.
Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Yeah, thank you, and to everyone here from Valley Catholic today. How does it work at your school? How old, what grades are students taught?
They're taught 6th grade, 8th grade, and 10th grade. Okay. Yeah.
And then is there a special training for the trainers?
Our teacher, Mr. Lohman over there, he's certified in all of it, so he knows.
Instructors, yeah, we're all certified CPR AED first aid instructors.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, questions for the team? Okay, well, thank you all. This
thank
is eye-opening. We know the right thing to do here, and we're trying to balance everything, so we appreciate you not only giving us this information, but also on how you help others in this regard. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 275? Then I'm going to close the public hearing on 275. I am going to go next door to testify on a memorial and come back in 5 minutes and turn the gavel over to Senator Canope to go through some university bills. We have a public hearing scheduled for 270 for purposes of looking at the amendment, but the amendment isn't done yet, but we did schedule it for today, and we do have someone signed up, so we'll go to that, and then
I'm gonna go that first.
Go down the list, and I shall return shortly.
Good luck.
We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 270. And we have Jonathan Farmer, who's here to talk on the bill.
That went to a crowd, didn't it? Oh, you really cleaned out the room.
Yeah, it's a lot less intimidating.
Yeah, don't get a complex over that. They weren't leaving because you were coming up.
All right. Well, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Farmer, and I'm the student body president at Western Oregon University and a board of directors member for the Oregon Student Association. OSA represents over 100,000 students statewide, and the 50,750 voters that we registered this year impact every single voting district across the state. This time we voted to oppose Senate Bill 270. We've stated that we would like to be a part of a decision on how to improve a bill like this, and I'm here to share the concerns of the students we represent statewide. First and foremost, the students believe in the ability of a statewide system to maintain accessible and affordable post-secondary education for all Oregonians, which is why we support oversight from entities like OUS or the HEC or the OE. There is actually a process that Chair Haas and Representative Dembro are working on to clarify the role of those boards. We would ask that you let that process develop further before making any final decisions about institutional boards. I would also like to cite the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education that affirmed states that use a single board to govern all four-year institutions are much more likely to have higher graduation rates compared to those states with mixed governance arrangements. A statewide system is crucially important to meeting the goals of our state, like 40-40-20. With all our resources and finest institutions working together, we can achieve more than if each institution is working in a silo. We would also like to reference the request for clarification of that larger governance model is a principle that we share with all seven university presidents. OSA knows the statewide system is better for serving Oregon families. We have previously supported bills like Senate Bill 242, which Chair Haas championed, and I'd like to thank him for that. It allowed for flexibility that institutions like PSU, OSU, and his alma mater of U of O have been asking for, but also maintain that accountability to the elected officials and keep students involved in meeting those statewide goals. So in 1929 is when we created that statewide system in Oregon because there was too much infighting and unnecessary competition between the schools. If this legislative session is any indication of the conflicts that could arise, OSA would again prefer a system that thinks about the benefit of all its players and the mission that they all have and in serving, again, all Oregonians. Some institutions claim to be able to stabilize those tuition costs with a large endowment, but at the same time do not commit to an in-state versus out-of-state ratio. And as a student body president for the most Oregon of all public universities, I understand that it would be easier for any institution to maintain lower tuition for in-state students if there was an unlimited ability to bring in out-of-state students. But we're not charged with educating the citizens of other states. I mean, at what point do we say enough is enough and focus on the fact that the school system needs stable funding, as Chair Haas points out? I would hope that this body recognizes that the stable funding should be funding that those responsible to all Oregonians have control over. Oregon is in the top 20% of more price-sensitive states, and without checks and balances from a statewide board and the legislature, we could see our big schools as a place only for the very wealthy or the few fortunate who have received a scholarship. This places the burden on educating more middle-income Oregonians on our regional campuses, but then offers them less support to do so. We do not feel that the current state of Senate Bill 270 is demonstrating a commitment, as again was voiced, to continue educational reforms that are working towards a seamless system that helps us reach our 40-40-20 goal. I know you've heard from us before on this, but I'd like to change the narrative a little bit. Student body presidents from large institutions are opposed to this bill as well because of what it might do to regional campuses. I want to be clear that the top priorities for OSA are competition between schools, increased costs, and representation, all things that could be amendments to this bill. Again, a competition between schools, increased costs, and representation. At Western, we do rely more on general fund dollars because we don't have the same donor base that the larger campuses have, but Senate Bill 270 intends to improve the donor base for some schools, which is great, but doesn't change the fact that this sets an unfair precedent to the regional campuses to have to go through a different budgeting process. They'd have to go through a campus budget process, an OUS process to share those resources, and then a process most likely at the HEC level. Whereas the larger campuses will only have a campus budget process and then possibly a HEC process. I believe it's clear why more campuses are talking about wanting an institutional board option. And this hybrid model appears to create more confusion and competition where none is really needed. On a personal note, I feel that placing an emphasis on more private dollars brings an emphasis on more private interests and clouds the public mission and the public interests of our public universities. We are also concerned that we haven't fleshed out the tuition setting process. We would be comfortable with a statewide entity having a check on tuition levels. And from a regional campus's perspective, I'm concerned about the precedence this sets to say that the oversight around tuition is not needed. On some campuses, we pay as much as 80% of the operating costs at a public school. We are frustrated that tuition and representation are not being considered. We are asking that you include the voice of your largest contributors in the decision-making process and that you protect Oregonians' hard-earned money by creating a third-party arbitrator for something as important as that tuition level. You've heard us testify on the potential for further administrative costs, so I'll just conclude by saying that we would like to be invited to the table to talk about this proposed monumental change. We have amendments we would like to suggest. Our concerns about costs, competition, and representation are not outlandish. We have reasonable concerns with this proposal that are not being addressed. Thank you for your willingness to make accessible education a top priority in this legislative session. And I ask that you recognize that I'm here today representing students from regional campuses, large schools, community colleges, and I'd like to close with a quote. Heroes are not giant statues framed against a red sky. There are people who say, this is my community, and it is my responsibility to make it better. Please stand with students in taking full responsibility to your community as a whole, and to vote no on this bill until some of the needs of your highest contributing community members are thoroughly considered. Thank you.
Any questions for Jonathan? Great. Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who is here to testify on Senate Bill 270 that hasn't had an opportunity to do so? If not, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 270, and we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 265, and I believe we... Oh, 265, 266, and 267. And we're going to invite Aletha, right? Aletha Miller to come up and be the administrator for these three bills. Come on up.
So, for the record, my name is Aletha Miller. I'm the intern administrator. Thank you for letting me do this, too. So, I would like to thank Vice Chair Knope and members of the committee. Senate Bill 265 authorizes the issuance of higher education revenue bonds in addition to bonds authorized pursuant to the biennial budget process for bond authorization. Senate Bill 266 creates an individualized process for the Oregon University System to enter into financing agreements. This is declared emergency passage. Senate Bill 267 changes the title President of State Board of Higher Education to Chairperson of Board, and there is a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means for Senate Bill 265.
Great. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Green. I'm the Associate Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration and Controller for the Oregon University System. Thank you very much for hearing from me today. The objective of Senate Bill 265 is to help provide diverse, flexible, and readily available capital financing for higher education projects. Senate Bill 265 modifies current statutes governing OUS revenue bonds, which are repaid wholly from university revenues and do not utilize the debt capacity of the state. Excuse me. Put these on. Current law requires that OUS obtain legislative authorization to issue revenue bonds for higher education projects. The current revenue bond authorization process, which is only available once each year, impedes the capital acquisition process, leading to lost opportunities and increased costs, creates inefficiencies in capital planning due to the time needed to secure legislative approval, and impacts the ability to secure donor support for jointly funded projects. Simply put, Senate Bill 265 modifies current law to allow issuance of OUS revenue bonds without legislative authorization. If Senate Bill 265 becomes law, OUS, working with the state treasurer, would be able to issue revenue bonds on the most optimal schedule, which would streamline the process and allow for a more efficient and effective execution of capital plans and reduce or eliminate the risk of lost opportunities with respect to property acquisition and donor support. Obtaining this flexibility will help OUS meet its 40-40-20 goal and is in line with the governor's tight-loose concept, being tight on outcomes while giving OUS the flexibility it needs to achieve those outcomes for all students. I did discuss this bill with state treasurer's representatives, and they had no specific concerns with it. That ends my testimony. Do you have any specific questions?
Any questions for Mr. Green? Nope. Thank you.
Thank you. Should I go on to 266?
You very well may.
Okay, thank you. Similar to the objective of Senate Bill 265, the objective of Senate Bill 266 is to help provide diverse, flexible, and readily available capital financing. Current law requires that OUS obtain legislative authorization either specifically to OUS or through an allocation from DAS to enter into financing agreements in excess of $100,000, even when repayment is made wholly from OUS revenues. The finance agreement process, authorization process in current law has the same negative attributes, I guess you'd call it, that I had mentioned in Senate Bill 265. It impedes the capital acquisition process, it creates inefficiencies in capital planning, and impacts the ability to secure donor support when we have jointly funded projects. Senate Bill 266 creates new law that allows OUS to enter into financing agreements without legislative authorization. It also includes some technical corrections to existing financing agreement statutes. If Senate Bill 266 becomes law, OUS would be able to enter into financing agreements as needed, which would streamline the process and allow for a more efficient and effective execution of capital plans and reduce or eliminate the risk of loss opportunities. As with Senate Bill 265, obtaining this flexibility would help OUS meet its 40-40-20 goal and is in line with that tight-loose concept I mentioned. I discussed this bill with the Treasurer's Office, and they indicated some concern with the proposed language. Specifically, their concern centers on the potential for cross-pledging of revenue streams with financing agreements and revenue bonds. And that specific concern comes from the fact that in the current financing agreement statutes, State Treasurer must approve the financing agreements before they're issued. This new language doesn't have that approval process in it. And the State Treasurer's Office would rather have that approval process in the bill. And if so directed, I could have amendments to this committee tomorrow to fix that. So and that ends my testimony on Senate Bill 266.
Great. Is there anyone else that wants to testify or has any questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't know if anybody's on 270 or not.
Yep. You're not going to testify on 267? Okay, great. Is Bridget Burns here? Come on up.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, or Chair Knope, members of the committee, for the record, Bridget Burns, Chief of Staff for the Oregon University System. I'm here to speak about Senate Bill 267 and just provide a little bit of background. This legislation is being brought to you because it is a recommendation from the Association of Governing Boards, which is a national organization that provides best practices recommendations for governing boards. It is their recommendation that governing boards, their leaders, be denoted as a chair instead of a president, because a president is typically the CEO of the institution or provides governing authority. And the chair is the person who provides leadership to the board or in a meeting. So this is merely about providing a lack of confusion and clearing that up, and also providing clarity and making it more in line with best practices nationally. I'm happy to answer any questions, but that's all I have to say.
Are there any questions? Great. Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on 265, 266, or 267?
I don't want to testify, but I do have a comment.
If Senator Cruz.
Okay. When I'm looking at 266, 265 and 266, I'm trying to get my hands around the fact that while we're consolidating all authority in the executive branch, we are continuing to remove oversight of the legislative branch, and that's a concern I have.
Thank you. Any other questions? Great. If not, we're going to close the hearings on 265, 266, and 267. And I'm going to turn the gavel back over to Chair Haas.
Nice work. Thank you.
We and passed them all, so. Did you do okay?
I think I did okay. Memorial for a fallen GI.
Cool.
26, 27.
All right.
So I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 567. Council, if you could summarize.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 267 directs the State Board of Education to appoint a chief privacy officer and charges that a position or the individual in that position with multiple privacy responsibilities.
Chris Ullman, you still here?
Good afternoon, Chris Allman for the record. First, I'd like to thank Senator Haas for introducing this bill on behalf of Oregon Save Our Schools. And I want to give a little information about myself. I'm a physician, an internist, and endocrinologist. I left medicine in the late 90s, and I went on to volunteer quite a bit in schools. I've been a court-appointed special advocate in Washington County. I've been involved in a Portland City Club Early Care and Education Research Committee. I was a Washington County Commissioner on Children and Families. And all of this helped inform me on this very important issue of privacy. Okay, let's see. First of all, I would like to actually propose an amendment because While I believe a chief privacy officer is very important in regards to how he, she would protect student privacy with compliance to federal and state law, I believe that, in fact, having a chief privacy officer for the state would be important to, so going to expanding beyond education. And indeed, there's precedence for this. Ohio is one of six states in the nation that has a chief privacy information officer. And actually, in our bill, section 11B, we go very well with what is their new addition on their website, the Ohio Privacy Impact Statement and Assessment. These would be of great help to all agencies to have this to assist them when they're working on policy. With big data and data mining, there is an eternal value of privacy. I think all of us are very well that there's a lot of commercial big data collection and exploitation that's going on. And our federal and state agencies are starting to collect quite a bit of information for the purposes of accountability, but also for surveillance. We all have a sense of understanding that trade secrets are important to a corporation, and I would like us to covet and safeguard identity for the same in the same way that we do for individuals. I wasn't really tuned into this issue until September of 2011. At that point, I was going to then what was called the OEIT, the Oregon Education Investment Team, before the members were confirmed. And I heard mention of something called Project Alder. I didn't know anything about that. I had to look it up. It stands for Advancing Longitudinal Data for Education Reform. And I heard something about it being referred to as a key deliverable. I got the specific minutes from that meeting and saw some troubling words in the passage. Individual students, expensive, define return on investment. All of this piqued my curiosity, and I wondered, where was this all coming from? I came to understand that a lot of it was being driven by the stimulus in 2009, that many states, all states were being urged to create state longitudinal data systems for education, that Project Alder was actually the third of federal grants that we got. In that case, there was $250 million spent helping support states. Actually, when it comes to healthcare and databases, the figures far more. Over $33 billion was allocated to healthcare and for total IT funding, and one provision in particular went to the high-tech section, which was purposely trying to work toward privacy-related issues in one subsection, and I'll talk more about that later. So this committee deals a lot with FERPA, I know, and that is a federal law that is dealing with student privacy. But the other law that I'm sure all of you are familiar with is HIPAA, regarding patient privacy. Maybe not so familiar with COPPA. COPPA is Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, and this is really purposefully for children under 13, as there is that concern about online protection for those more vulnerable to manipulation at that age. All of these laws are delegated to certain agencies that then can have rules to redefine how the laws are interpreted. That brings me to the Electronic Privacy Information Center, where I learned a lot about what was happening in 2011 because there were proposed rule changes. And there were many groups that were very concerned about what was happening in that the intent was to open up more data collections and data to third parties without parental or student consent. So the Electronic Privacy Information Center, after these rule changes were implemented in December of 2011, decided to sue the U.S. Department of Education using the Administrative Procedural Act, saying that the new rule changes are contrary to the law, and that is still sitting in the federal court right now. So what happens with bigger data when you have breaches? Well, the Eugene School District would be a good school district to ask. They had 16,000 records that were breached this past summer. So I decided to think about how I might get access to the electronic records and requested of our the department, our Department of Education, to see my son's electronic educational records. I was the first in the state to do it, perhaps the first in the nation to have accessed them. I got a CD. I shared that with Senator Haas last fall. And what I found was disturbing because it included a lot of personally identifiable information, and it included a lot of confidential information, including my son's extensive vaccine history and discipline records. This troubled me. I looked at the enrollment records, and I was puzzled because my son, from four times between fourth and eighth grades, was labeled W8. And I had to figure out what that was, so I went to the Department of Ed's website to look at the data format files and saw that W-8 meant left to earn a GED. I assure you, my son did not leave for a GED. So I tried to figure out why that occurred. I went to speak with Steve Langford in the Beaverton School District, and he couldn't figure out how that happened. I emailed the Department of Education, you know, saying, hey, this is wrong. How do I correct this? Why did this happen? And the response basically was that the SLDS system is not the system of record. It isn't used for federal or state accountability. So, exploring more about this, I found that the Department of Education has a data collection committee that's working on continued reforms and how states are going to crosstalk about data. So, what has come about over the past year or so is the third draft of what's called the Common Education Data Standards. So, this is the codes for just disciplinary action alone. And you can see that here we have even more information that as you start to think about the codes and what they mean and how they might be put into educational records could be rather concerning. So how does this all interact with health? Well, for one, we know that there are a lot of school-based healthcare centers that are potentially going to be uploading a lot of sensitive information. That's one thing to think about. But also, there's the Early Learning Council, which is being incorporated in this longitudinal database. And last summer, the ELC requested a federal waiver for HIPAA and FERPA as needed for data sharing because the home visits are going to be looking at this additional information. And this brings us back to HITECH and what was a provision of the stimulus bill. HITECH has data breaches being posted that are more than 500 individuals. And there have been lots of data breaches since then. In fact, the largest one last year was an agency. The Utah Department of Health had a weak password, and nearly 800,000 patient files were compromised. Unfortunately, in January, just this last month, another 6,000 Medicaid patients from that department were misplaced with a USB device. When I was looking at Project Alder, something really stood out, the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education, WICHE. I was seeing that they were very much involved in the earliest stages of trying to get this longitudinal database put together, and that the intent was to have a regional data exchange. As I was trying to explore information regarding this and try to get public record requests for data sharing agreements, I didn't get where I wanted to until recently I got this public record, which basically showed that there is a regional data exchange that was funded by the Gates Foundation. Notice that this started in September of 2011, 2 months before the FERPA changes were put into place. There are other, the National Student Clearinghouse is involved in this memorandum of agreement. There are four states, Washington, Oregon, Hawaii, and Idaho, that are going to be compiling education and workforce data. And it's very clear that they're going to want explicit information, social security numbers, any combination of information that together would make it possible to easily identify individuals. The agencies that are involved in Oregon, Department of Ed, Community Colleges and Workforce Development, Oregon University System, and the Employment Department. Now, last year, the U.S. Department of Education hired their first chief privacy officer, Kathleen Stiles, and she has a great website, the Privacy Technical Assistance Center. This would be a great resource for any chief privacy officer to try to minimize data breaches and follow policy well. But she's also, in addition to advocating for compliance with law, is saying that we need to implement fair information practices. And the expert who she quotes in this blog post is someone who's actually been doing his work primarily in healthcare, and Bob Gelman is his name. But the point is that in trying to consider how to do this well, one needs to know what kind of data is being collected and who's getting access to it. How do you, there are many principles in mind, and so she goes into more detail in regards to this. But data minimization is one of them, and certainly as I look at the Common Education Data Standards, I worry that that is a problem. So as I think about privacy, there are many who might even think that the way to go about it, because, well, you know, nobody thinks privacy really exists anymore in the Internet, is why not commodify it? Why not make privacy kind of a currency, so to speak? Well, I can tell you who has a heads up in regards to privacy in our state, and that would be Rupert Murdoch. You see, Rupert Murdoch with News Corp has an education division, and that education division is called Amplify. This was just started last year. The intention is to market lots of Internet-based educational products. They're targeting middle school students, teachers, and parents. Also under the umbrella of Amplify is a company called Wireless Generation. Turns out that Wireless Generation was awarded the ability to report data for the Smarter Balance Assessment Consortium. That is the testing consortium to which Oregon is aligned. So my feeling is that it's important, really, that we indeed should be protecting privacy. And I'm just going to leave you with this quote from Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis, who defines privacy as the right to be left alone, the most comprehensive rights of rights, and the right most valued by a free people. Thank you.
I open it. Thank you. Questions? No.
I'd just like to thank her for all the research that she's done. That's incredible.
Well, we do have some other people who would like to speak on this bill, Chris. Let me call up Lisa Schultz. Lisa's a former school board member in Beaverton.
That's correct.
Served well.
Good afternoon, Chairman Haas and members of the committee. My name is Lisa Schultz, and as Senator Haas just stated, I am a former member of the Beaverton School Board. I have a master's degree in electrical engineering and have worked in the high-tech industry for over 30 years. I am currently employed as a staff engineer for Mentor Graphics Corporation. Mentor Graphics manufactures software for electronic circuit design and verification. I'm also the mother of a recent graduate from Beaverton School District's Early College High School program, and I am very, very pleased to be here today and to have this opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 567. Two recent changes in education have made it essential for the legislature to act and establish strong data privacy protections for students. First, school districts are no longer the sole custodian of student education records. Beginning in 2006, Oregon, along with the majority of other states, established a statewide longitudinal database system into which individual student records are uploaded from districts rather than transferring data aggregated by cohorts. This data contains a student's personal identifying information and includes not only grades and test scores, but disciplinary data, counseling and medical information, and much more. The amount of data being collected appears to be growing rapidly. I want to point out that I did not know of the existence of the statewide database, either as a parent of a child in public school, nor as a board member. I only recently learned of this in the past year and have been frankly astonished at what I have found. Second, a rule change was made to the Federal Education Rights and Privacy Act, FERPA, at the end of 2011 that weakened the law, allowing third-party access to student data without the knowledge or consent of students or their families. A lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Education regarding the rule change has been filed by the Electronic Privacy and Information Center in Washington, D.C. The rule change has also been denounced by the American Association of Collegiate Registrars and Admissions Officers, the ACLU, the National Association of Independent Colleges and Universities, and many others. The U.S. Department of Education itself agrees that current protections are inadequate and has urged states to adopt broad data minimization practices and to apply additional restrictions and protections to data systems containing personally identifiable information. It is important to note that children are at significantly higher risk for identity theft than adults, and FERPA does not allow for any compensation to be paid to victims in the event of a data breach. Recovering from child identity theft often takes years and costs families in the United States billions of dollars every year. During this time, a student may not be able to work or go to school or may face charges for crimes they did not commit. Identity theft and data tampering of student data can leave children exposed for their entire lifetime through no fault of their own, creating the potential for years of stress and lost opportunities. This bill establishes the very basic right of students to know what information is being collected about them, who will have access to that information, and how it will be used. It gives students the right to correct information that is in error and allows students the opportunity to agree or refuse to provide personal information that is not required by state or federal law. It is worth noting that the National School Boards Association, in their comments regarding the 2011 FERPA rule change, specifically stated, "Nothing in the FERPA statute states that a state educational agency has authority to receive non-consensual personal identifying information from one education agency to evaluate another education agency." In a climate of rapid and complex technological changes, the increasing amount of data collected and stored by education entities and the ramifications in the event of a data breach, both legal and otherwise, the position of a chief privacy officer is essential to ensure that the children of Oregon are adequately protected. When personal data is collected and aggregated into a structure, safety and security does not happen by accident. It must be carefully thought out and designed into a system. Although I understand there is a cost associated with establishing this position, and these are very tough economic times for sure, the potential harm the state could face as a result of a data breach is significant, and this position is a prudent step toward establishing a system of safeguards that will benefit Oregon's students throughout their lifetime. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. I have submitted written and electronic testimony, and there's a page of useful references that you might find helpful.
Senator Cruz?
Yeah, I'm just curious, a thought just occurred to me, how there can be medical records that are being transmitted without a violation of HIPAA?
Well, in conversations that I had, I contacted Daniel Soloff, who's a privacy attorney in Washington, D.C. He's a professor at George Washington University. To be succinct, somehow FERPA trumps HIPAA, and I'm not an attorney and don't understand how that can be, but that I think you legal counsel could probably help answer that question.
FERPA trumps HIPAA.
That I find that extraordinary and very troubling, Mr. Chair.
The analogy was made to trade secrets here. I'm just curious what Mentor Graphics might, do you see any parallels that you have set up to guard against breach of secrets?
Well, that's one of the things that I find interesting is that we have very strict privacy protections, and they aren't reflected in what you see happening in public education. So, for example, the cloud that you all may be familiar with and have heard about, we are expressly prohibited from putting any data into the cloud that would be personal or private in any way. The only thing you could put in the cloud is something that you would have out for public use, such as a marketing presentation or sales information for the public. So we have a whole organization that is dedicated to privacy protection. We have a whole floor of attorneys that work on that sort of thing. And so it's a focus, certainly, of our work, and it's something that public education organizations definitely are not currently equipped to handle. I will say that, for example, the Beaverton School District, the chief information officer there, Steve Langford, does an extremely good job within the district. And that's been traditionally that school districts have been the custodians of the records. And they understand and are equipped, although it's a challenge with changing technology. What becomes very difficult is when they release the records into the longitudinal database, the district no longer has visibility into what happens to those records. And so they're sort of out there, and if there is a breach, it's hard sometimes to know how to trace that back. So it really increases the risk factor enormously to be releasing records away from their primary source where they're generated.
Thank you, Lisa. Appreciate your insights on this and for coming down here.
Okay, thank you so much.
Let's hear from the Oregon Department of Education, Dion Baird and Jan McComb, if you're both here.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jan McComb, the Legislative Director for the Department of Education, and I brought with me today Dion Baird, who is the department's Chief Information Security Officer. And we're just here to talk about what the department does now and answer some questions.
Okay.
So, good afternoon, Chair Haas and Senate Education Committee members. Again, for the record, I'm Dion Baird. I'm Chief Information Security Officer for the Department of Education, and I have been since January of 2008. I'm here today to provide information about Senate Bill 567, what we currently do, and as we know, this is the bill that calls for a chief privacy officer. One thing I would like to add is I do take my job seriously. I protect that data like my son's data is in there because it is. So I keep that in mind every day. As proposed, the duties of the chief privacy officer would be to protect student data, advise the state board on standards for creation, use, custody, and disclosure of student education records in a manner consistent with state and federal laws, ensure that the schools, districts, and ESDs comply with all Oregon and federal regulations and are acting in good faith to protect the privacy of the student data.
Dan, if I could stop you.
Yes, sir.
To be clear, you're not here promoting or opposing the bill. You're neutral on the bill.
I am completely neutral. That's correct.
Right now, you're just reading through what it does, what the bill does.
Chair Haas, that's correct. Okay. Just the requirements for the CPO, Chief Privacy Officer.
Okay.
Sanction schools, districts, and ESD that don't fall into compliance. Issue an assessment of any data system, program, or contract involving personally identifiable information, or PII, that contains student, parent, or legal guardian information, and publish those assessments on the ODE website. And finally, to administer the Oregon Electronic Student Record Program as described in ORS 326.580. So currently, we do quite a bit of this already at ODE, and I'd like to cover just a little bit of that. So right now I maintain a complete privacy, information security and privacy program. I educate all employees on an annual basis. I remind them why we're there, for the students that we have, you know, data on 600,000 plus students. We protect that data, and I take my job very seriously. We do, again, provide an annual training every year for that. Last year, I initiated a collaborative effort with the school districts and the education service districts to launch a statewide education information security council. And what we were trying to do there was give the districts and the schools resources that they didn't have to be able to provide them framework, to implement security programs, write security policies, find out where they're at, just kind of get a feeler for where they're at. It's been well attended, it's been well received, and we've done a lot of great work already as far as the information security program with them. We also monitor changes in state and federal regulations and update ODE procedures to meet new requirements. And we've got, I'm not going to list them all, Chair Haas, but we do have quite a few policies related to information security. Some of them I've written myself. Just important ones off the top: handling confidential information, not taking data out of the building on flash drives, ensuring that that data doesn't walk away. If we have employees that need to visit schools with that data, making sure they put it on an iron key where it's encrypted so that the data is never publicly available, even if they lost the iron key. There was a couple of others. An information asset classification where we've gone through, we've basically inventoried the type of data that we keep on hand. We've applied an asset classification policy to that data so that we know if it should be public data, is it somewhat public data, but we still don't want it getting, you know, out unless there's an FOIA request, or is it private and confidential data that we need to protect. This was in accordance with a lot of the work that DAS was doing. An information security policy that I wrote that's fairly detailed, and I can provide copies of any of these to yourself, Chair, or any of the committee members if they would like. An incident handling response guide that I wrote. We are also very compliant with the Oregon Consumer Identity Theft Protection Act. We do conduct internal security audits against our own systems, and we do that at all levels, hardware, data. So we call it pen testing, penetration testing, to see if we can penetrate our own applications. Maintain business continuity and disaster recovery plans. Data sharing agreements with any partner state agencies. So we put very defined parameters around how that data is used, how it's disposed of once they're done using it, what's the disposition of the data, how is it stored at rest, how is it transported.
Would you say, in effect, then, that you are the chief privacy officer?
I would say that I've been doing a lot of the job, Chair Haas.
Well, is there anything that you see in this bill before us that you're not doing?
There were a couple of things, and thank you for asking. So doing the gap analysis on this, Chair Haas and committee members, the things that I see that we don't truly do at this point, we do not advise the state board. So the state board doesn't come to me and ask me for recommendations on policy or advice. We don't sanction schools, districts, and ESDs that don't fall into compliance. This was one of the reasons that we started the EISC, was to, you know, instead of a stick, we tried to use a carrot. Let's bring them in. Let's educate them. I mean, that's what we are. We're education. Let's help people, and let's get our, you know, let's get our arms around this. And I don't currently administer the Oregon Electronic Student Record Program. Also, I would like to add one caveat. As far as assessment on data programs or data systems or contracts involving any of this PII data or anything else, I only, or the IT section at ODE only assesses anything internal to ODE. So we don't go out and assess district systems or school systems. That's all under their purview.
What call does the federal government have on your data?
The only, as far, I'm sorry, first time testifying, so.
You're doing good.
So Senator Haas, Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, the federal government, as far as I know, all we do is we report aggregate data to the federal government. So FERPA is very, very, very strict by definition to say you're only allowed to, in reports, present aggregate data. And as a matter of fact, if you present aggregate data that's so small that an individual could be identifiable out of that aggregate data, you're not allowed to report that aggregate data. So we're not allowed to report individual information to the federal government.
Okay. So relatively scrubbed, if I could follow up.
Yes, sir.
And Mr. Chair, the reason I bring this up is federal data systems scare the hell out of me. But, you know, because bad things can happen once our data gets outside the purview of the state of Oregon. So,
Well, Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, 12 years in the military, I worked with top secret security clearance, so I don't particularly like my data being in a new million square foot NSA data center either, but, you know, I can protect what's under my purview, and I do.
The sanctions to school districts and ESDs, I understand what you said about the carrots over a stick, but sometimes you have to do both. That seems like a fairly substantive policy direction. You could do that internally or maybe through rule or with direction from the board. You wouldn't necessarily need something in law to do that. I'm asking.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, we might need something in law. Right now our big stick is withholding state school funds. And if we were to be expected to sanction schools, I think we would want to write a policy that set out the criteria for when we would sanction, for how much, and we would want to have an investigation that was proper. Right now, when we get FERPA complaints, we turn those over to the U.S. Federal Department of Education. We don't investigate ourselves. We're just not staffed at that level. And so, it could happen. We would just want to make sure that we have the infrastructure to do that.
So, Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, one thing I'd like to add to that is, so the individual that runs PTAC for the Federal Department of Education is Baron Rodriguez. He used to be the CIO for the Oregon Department of Education.
Yeah.
Very good friend of mine. So I work with Baron and try to stay in very. I try to make sure that we're following federal guidelines and federal regulations and meeting those and trying to find out what's coming that I can know about so that we're ahead of the game.
And Chair Haas, members of the committee, PTAC stands for? It was referenced by Ms. Ullman in her slideshow.
I believe it's Privacy Technical Analysis Center.
There are more acronyms in this discussion than any.
And Chair Haas, don't quote me on that because that I could very well be wrong.
Okay.
Senator, I would probably like to get from the department when we heard that FERPA trumps HIPAA, that I find that really hard to believe. Do you have any definition of that? I mean, medical records, I think, were supposed to be the most sacrosanct thing we have, and now we're hearing that the education records system can mine data from HIPAA, and that I find that troubling.
Well, Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, I think that if that question were to come to me, and I was sitting in my desk, one of the things that I would do is pick up the phone and call the PTAC and say, hey, I want some advice from the feds on, you know, how do you see this?
Could you get that opinion from us? I think that would be helpful.
I can get that opinion for you.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Boy, you've really opened up a whole can here, haven't you?
Oh, a whole PTAC can. Yeah.
So, Senator Haas, members of the committee, one last thing I'd like to add is I did hear a reference to the cloud, and I want to make, I'd just like to make everybody aware, we do not store our data in the cloud. So I'm very against, we have a private cloud, that's my cloud, I own it. I protect it religiously, and we do not store data on anybody else's network or systems.
Thank you both. We'll take this up another day.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on SB 567 and open up a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 540. Council Richard.
Thank you, Senator Haas, members of the committee. Senate Bill 540 establishes the Task Force on School Capital Improvement Planning. It modifies or works, is the second generation of a previous task force that did something similar as a result of a House bill in 2009. Senate Bill 540 does contain a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. We have some people who are going to testify. I think Senator Devlin is also involved in this. For now, we have Elise Brown and her team.
She's got a team?
Shelley Berman, Chris Dudley.
I got the credit, so yeah.
What happens when you retire?
Chairman Haas, members of the committee, I'm Chris Dudley, a retired Oregon School Boards Association Executive Director and the co-founder of the Center for Innovative School Facilities, a nonprofit group of volunteers dedicated to improving the health and safety of Oregon's schools. Our mission is to advance student achievement by improving place and community. Our long-term goal is to have a well-structured facility plan for school facilities in the state of Oregon. The center and its experienced staff of more than 100 volunteers statewide has been assisting school districts around the state for the last 6 years. Work began with site-specific technical assistance to several districts and expanded to reflect the four programs that have been laid out in our five-year strategic plan: research and inventory, standards and technology, education and technical assistance, and advocacy and funding. If you see the column on the left side indicates the statewide leaders panel, a group of business, community, and government leaders from around the state whose names you see on the handout is guiding the changes we are proposing for Oregon. They believe that facilities need to follow the education policy in the state and need to provide secure and healthy learning environments and up-to-date technology. They've seen the center's research and data analysis that shows that thousands of students in Oregon are in unsafe buildings and in classrooms that, if there were a simple addition of a wireless microphone, would substantively increase learning. The leaders panel is also very aware of the huge financial pressures today on the state and on education education programs. They realize that the need is much bigger than the resources we have, and therefore we must have the data with which to prioritize, to develop partnerships, to find savings, and to integrate pre-K through community college delivery of education. The current situation should not continue. A growing reality for almost all of Oregon's school districts is the increased inability to address deferred capital maintenance, some of which is now being called abandoned maintenance, and the need to improve the physical learning environments within school facilities to support the new teaching practices or provide access to technology. The many unsafe and unhealthy and technologically archaic K-12 facilities reinforce a call for change to align with what we expect in terms of our new education strategy into the future. Oregon is one of seven states nationally that has no staff at the state level dedicated to capital programs. It is one of 15 where state participation in capital costs. And this ranges, if you look at, there are some states where 100% of the capital construction comes from the state, and that's not what we're looking at, but there's a big variance between states. Oregon is sort of at the bottom of the list. So what What would the state get with the bill we're proposing? National models indicate that statewide services are best provided from a state agency or a department. While the center has initiated many of the programs that reflect the typical state structure, it is nonetheless a nonprofit without designation or authority to serve Oregon's districts. This manifests itself in a number of ways, including the extraordinary number of hours it takes to access the public data, the time it takes as an outsider to coordinate with state agencies on policy, on program delivery issues, and to avoid duplication of efforts. Our bill proposes public-private partnerships that measurably increase the state's investment by bringing both cash and in-kind resources to the issue. Specifically, the panel and the center initiative delivers, first, from a task force, a strategic framework with recommended programs and funding tools will help districts and legislators set priorities and develop cost-saving partnerships. Second, from the inventory, a data hub that helps local, regional, and state-level leaders in setting priorities, developing policy, planning, and making decisions that integrate early learning K-12 and community college priorities. And third, from a technical assistance standpoint, 2 years of intensified technical assistance that directly assists every district helps any district that wants it to help set their priorities and develop cost-saving partnerships. Basically, we see this as a way to preserve what we have done and transfer it to an agency that will keep it going. And we think this is a strategic investment that will way outweigh in its benefits what it would cost.
Thank you. Chair Hess, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you on this bill. Let me provide a little bit of background. This is my 20th year as a superintendent. I spent 14 years in Massachusetts, 4 years in Kentucky, and now I've been here for a year and a half.
Dr. Berman, start off with identifying yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Sheldon Berman, superintendent of schools in Eugene, Oregon. When I was in Massachusetts, in fact, I was the president of the Superintendents Association and spent a good deal of time working at a state level on the reconfiguration of funding for facilities and as well as the shifting of that to an independent organization set to support the construction and bonding of facilities in Massachusetts. And we spent a good deal of time looking at both the structure of funding and how to assess buildings. And when I was in Kentucky, we also were engaged in a fairly extensive survey of all buildings in the state and a classification of buildings, much like the inventory that's proposed in this bill. Why I'm here is speaking from the perspective of a local superintendent who has spent the last 15 months deeply engaged in a facility study within our own district, and now having put a bond measure on the ballot for May, looking at the replacement of four of our buildings. I've become aware of a number of things that, in terms of the funding structure as well as the data that's maintained in the state about buildings. So let me offer a couple of insights. What my understanding has become about the funding of education in Oregon is that equity is deeply tied to that funding. That equity is a key principle in the allocation of funds to school districts. However, in the area of capital expenditures, and particularly in the area of buildings, that equity principle does not necessarily apply. That, in fact, communities that have the need or the capacity or the will are able to replace their buildings or renovate their buildings when those that may not have the capacity or will or need do not. So there's a real discrepancy between the funding formula and the capital investment formula that the state has. In addition, there's very little in the way of a database to compare building to building in terms of conditions across communities and across the state. So it's difficult to assess how, whether a building in Eugene is in worse or better condition than a building in Portland or any other area of the state. So in fact, although I know that there's a great deal of interest in terms of the local community making decisions around the investment in their capital infrastructure for schools,
it would be of significant benefit to have a database, a state database, to assess where you are and to begin to set up a structure for looking more broadly in a very disciplined way at the infrastructure statewide for education. One of the areas of exploration that we did as a school district was to take a deep look at the impact of school facilities on student performance. And from my read of the data, there's a fairly direct and significant impact on student performance. So as we looked at our buildings, we began saying, how do we invest when, in particular, these are very hard economic times? This kind of structure puts in place, I think, the building blocks for communities to have the support to make those decisions and to make those in a more authoritative way. So with that, I would encourage the community to support this as a systemic and a systematic way of addressing facilities in the state and beginning to take a deeper look at how you can bring equity to the dialogue about and to the funding of school buildings. Thank you.
Thank you. If you two want to stay up there, Senator Devlin will join you.
Okay.
This is a cleanup pattern.
Better?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for indulging me at this time. I'm coming here in support of this bill for probably many reasons, and I do not have prepared comments, but I think I can express pretty clearly what I think is the importance of this bill. There has been a growing issue in terms of the condition of the infrastructure in our public schools. There has also been a growing effort in terms of funding community college facilities at the state level. Let me take the second one first, community colleges. It wasn't that many bienniums ago, actually, I believe it was only about four, when this state could have completely been out of the business of actually funding community college facilities. Our debt service was running out for our remaining bonds, and we could have simply chosen to walk the other way. But what we chose to do was over a period of about three bienniums to issue roughly in the neighborhood of about $40 million of a biennium, in many cases largely to assist community colleges that had infrastructure that was actually completely failing and actually for equity purposes ended up having to do quite a number of others. As you may be well aware, we also passed a measure with the public, a constitutional measure, giving us the authority to actually issue bonds to assist school districts. Well, here's the fundamental issue that is there. One, I will tell you that contrary to what some people might say here today, we probably have only limited capability to assist school districts with capital needs. However, it is a very significant public issue. We have a very high expectation from community colleges that they will have continued capital expenditure needs that they will come to the state for. In fact, they have a little bit more than $110 million in requests in this biennium, and in the governor's recommended, there's about $68 million of that. We all recognize that the public school issue is a very significant issue, but we are absent from data that really gives us a broad picture of where we are particularly at. You will all have anecdotal evidence. The school districts actually do have a bill in asking for $200 million for capital needs. We will, by the end of this biennium, or probably issue well over $1 billion in new debt for capital needs. We need to actually have a much broader view of what our capital needs are and what our capital priorities are. To do that, we need information, particularly in the case of community colleges, which I understand they have some concern about being in this bill. if this bill goes on to Ways and Means, we could simply move them out, and I simply can put a requirement in that for future community college projects, community colleges will have to submit their facilities plans so that we know how their project requests fit within their facilities plans. That's something that the co-chairs of Ways and Means can actually do pretty directly. But the issue that we have out here is that we need more information. Just to give you an idea of something that used to be in place a number of years ago, the Department of Ed kept literally a list of all of the public school buildings in the state and the age of the buildings. You would be surprised at how many of those 10, 15 years ago were well over 50 years of age. We need to be able to understand this problem. Within this bill, there's a very small public expenditure. In fact, to give you an idea of why I'm so interested in information, if we're going to continue to issue $1 billion plus in capital bonding every biennium, we can afford to spend a few hundred thousand dollars to actually figure out what our true priorities are. And I can actually extend that discussion back a bit. Do any of you know the condition of all state facilities? State facilities. I'll go away from the OUS system. Well, the Ways and Means Committee will ultimately make a recommendation to you, and we don't know. Do we know the condition of all OUS facilities? No. But we will make a recommendation to the full legislature on what the priorities should be. Do we know the condition of all of our correctional facilities? No. But we will make a recommendation on what the most important improvements are in there. We need to get to a point with capital improvements where we really make informed decisions, where those decisions are made on the basis of what is the best and highest priority for the use of capital funds and what is the return on that investment. And all we're asking is actually just for a little bit of ability to start to get some of those decisions in this bill. I'll just leave it at that, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions for our panel? Very much appreciate the work and your work, Mr. Dudley, on this. And that was a very cogent summary, Senator. And thank you.
Thank you.
I think, Mr. Chairman, if we're ever going to get to a cohesive policy, we want to start we're trying to develop a public-private partnership right now within the next 2 years where we'll have an information base. So depending on that, we can have some policy discussion about it, and we can continue to have technical assistance to school districts on their building projects. And that's what this is about for us.
Thank you.
If I could just add one other comment. As we were beginning to do our analysis in Eugene around which buildings needed to be replaced, our average age of our buildings is well over 50 years old, we engaged a company called MGT of America to assess the quality of each of our buildings and give us a detailed report. That report actually framed the recommendations that we were then able to put forward to the community in a fairly unbiased and neutral way that said, here's an assessment of the systems, the building conditions, the educational compatibility and capability of a building. And so we had a very thorough analysis to build on. I think this is what Senator Devlin has been speaking to give that kind of grounding would be very helpful for all of us. In addition, as we think about, and as I think about the incentives for a community, if you have that kind of analysis and then the state is able to provide incentives that encourage communities to move forward and revitalize their facilities, it creates a very nice system of support where you have data. You're making database decisions, and then you are actually having an incentive for following those decisions and improving the facilities for children. So thank you very much for
makes those decisions
hearing this.
Yes, thank you. We are running out of time here. We have one more person signed up, Mr. Morgan Allen from the Oregon School Boards Association. Always brief.
He's been known to be brief from time to time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Morgan Allen, the Oregon School Boards Association. My first job here in 1997 was a Senate floor page, and one of the first things I heard is you never testify after a co-chair. And yet here I am, low many years later, doing exactly that. Wanted to offer a couple comments on the bill. Would urge the committee to send it on to Ways and Means, but we feel there could be some improvements made to the bill, and I'll just mention two specifically since time is short. The first thing in the bill that we have some concerns about, in Section 4, it grants the Department of Education some pretty broad authority to gather data on school facilities, including things about energy usage, education performance. And so if we'd like to see that at least tightened up or at least some sort of justification. We wouldn't, you know, if a school district has their own facility plan or they have, or they're doing bonding, they're taking care of their own facilities, you know, maybe they don't have to report to the state. Why should every district in the state potentially have to do this massive new data collection if they're already doing it themselves, especially if there's no state money involved with that? The second issue is it creates essentially a Department of Technical Assistance for K-12 capital construction at the Oregon Department of Education. They currently have no capacity there. Brian Reeder steps in and helps districts where he can, but there's some funding in there, and what we would rather see potentially is if school districts want to go out and talk to architects or people that do facilities planning, like the folks that came up and testified today, we would rather see grant monies available to districts to do that work themselves. So again, with all the folks that testified, agree with the problem, agree with the end game where we want to get, have a little bit different perspective on how we get there. So we appreciate the opportunity to keep working with them and sharing our thoughts. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
So I'm going to go submit my application as a Senate floor page.
Yes. You flunked Senate page school. We're in a work session. My sense committee, this is not pre-wired or anything, but is to send this on to Ways and Means and let them duke out some of the details on financing.
Then we're allowing substantive amendments in Ways and Means.
Maybe.
Just a thought.
They're not supposed to do programmatic changes in Ways and Means.
If that's the direction that they decide to go. Well, I detect a pause.
Yeah, I think Morgan had a valid point there, and I wouldn't take that long to get an amendment just to make that change. Huh?
Well, what? All right, then. That's okay. We will carry over Senate Bill 540 to a future meeting. Morgan Allen can talk to the co-chair in the meantime about the status of any other bills you may be...
Mr. Chair, just for the record, I'm not trying to oppose this. I just want to make sure we have a right before we send it down.
Yeah.
That's all.
Okay, so we will close public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 540, and we're at 2:45. Without any other further business, we'll adjourn.